Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mona, we've been doing the show for over 5 years, and nothing has been like it has been lately as far as all the new updates with EB5. It's going one way, it's going the other. What's happening?
Oh, yeah, it's hard even to get a hold of what's going on. It's changing daily right now, Mark. So we really thought carefully as to who would be the right person who would be able to at least discuss all the different areas that we're talking about right now. We were talking about litigation, agency, legislative, as well as marketing, and poor investors don't even know where to turn. So we thought Sam Odani, he's one guy who really has his finger on the button.
Sam, welcome back to the show.
Delighted to be back, Mark.
Welcome back, Sam. Okay, yesterday morning, right at the 11th hour, as expected, USCIS appealed the Ninth Circuit case, Behring case. They haven't asked for a stay, but this is pretty significant.
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, there's never a dull moment in immigration, is the old saw. But I have to say that as of yesterday, the sentiment was that there is never, ever a dull moment in EB5. So, you know, I mean, there's been a maelstrom of activity in EB5. In the last 2 months, we've seen more change in EB5 than in the last 30 years. And particularly with what's been going on since yesterday, you know, there are three different axes, the litigation axis in the courts, the agency axis in the executive branch, and the legislative axis in Congress. All the three, there's activity, and all of it affects investment decisions.
Really? Absolutely. Yeah. Well, just so that our listeners are up to date, in case anybody doesn't know, first of all, we are talking about an appeal to the Behring Regional Center lawsuit. And just as a very quick update, back in December 2020, the Behring Regional Center filed a motion for a preliminary injunction against DHS to basically block the implementation of the EB5 modernization rule, which came in November 19th. And the bottom line was the increase from the minimum amount of $500,000 to $900,000. That was the most notable change. Back in June 22nd, 2021, literally 8 days before the expiration of the Regional Center program, Judge Jacqueline Scott Corley issued a ruling effectively reverting the EB5 investment program to pre-November 2019 regulations. The ruling really found that the former Homeland Security head, he was not lawfully serving in the position that he was supposed to because he wasn't ratified properly by the Senate. As of yesterday, we weren't even sure whether USCIS were even going to appeal. Now that they haven't filed a stay, but Sam, perhaps you could explain to our listeners, what does this mean?
Everyone expects USCIS to eventually lose the appeal. So the issue is never the appeal itself. The issue is the stay. And what does the stay mean? If there is no stay, either asked for or issued, then the current status quo continues, which means we continue the market at 500K and with the liberal TEA definitions.
Right. But at the same time, Sam, I think that most litigators familiar will say that there really isn't any reason for a stay because you only file a stay when there's imminent harm. And clearly, when you file on the last day and we've been doing all of these petitions, there's no imminent harm.
That's a good point. The agency has certainly undercut any argument for imminent harm by waiting for the 60th day and the minute before midnight to file its appeal. But it's not just that. I believe that you have to, under Ninth Circuit rules, if you ask for a stay, you have to make some kind of showing to the court that you have a theory as to how you might succeed.
Right.
It is very difficult to argue that within the context of the asylum decision made already by a Ninth Circuit panel back in December last year, which concerned the exact same act, the Federal Vacancies Reform Act, which was the issue in this case. So that is why almost everybody involved in this case, everyone that I know who's looked at the litigation here, expects the USCIS to eventually lose. But the stay would matter dramatically. If they could obtain a stay, then it would basically serve USCIS's purposes in reverting the market back to the 900,000 level with restricted definitions of TEAs. So that's why the issue of whether a stay is issued or is not issued is important, Mona.
bear in mind, Sam, right now we are talking about a very limited market. We're not talking about the regional center market. We're just talking about direct only. So whether or not they even feel it's worth putting all that argument in for just the direct program, I kind of doubt.
Well, that is one way of looking at it. There is an alternative way. After all, let us suppose Congress were to return back on September 15th, and it is entirely plausible, I'm not saying probable, but plausible, that they could reauthorize the regional center program. Well, in that case, whether USCIS has at that point received a stay or becomes extremely important. So it's not just a matter of the direct market. Even the regional center market should be, and as to the best of my knowledge, is, in fact, watching this development very closely, because it will affect them should reauthorization occur.
But Sam, do you think they're pushing so hard because they anticipate bringing back the regional center program, the EB-5 pilot program, and they want to have this in place so they can have it under their modernization rules?
Well, only USCIS knows what it's doing. And it's important to bear in mind that the issue of the stay is not necessary that a stay order be requested from the panel of the Ninth Circuit at the same time as the appeal is filed. To the best of my knowledge, the USCIS can request a stay later on in the process. If they want to, perhaps maybe they want to wait for reauthorization and then ask for a stay. So the issue of stay is not resolved just because, as best as we can make out at this point, the agency has not asked for a stay. That doesn't mean that it will never ask for a stay while this litigation proceeds. This litigation may go on for a year before the Ninth Circuit chooses in its wisdom to make a decision.
I can tell you one rule of the appellate procedure is that a stay must first be filed in the district court. In the lower court decision, the stay was just a footnote. There was no request and no real motion. So whether they do it or not, I'm not sure. But also, there was an indication a few weeks ago when the USCIS on their website did repeat their argument as to how they cured the defect, that the current DHS secretary was properly ratified. And if he says it's okay, it's the defect's cured. So it's up to whether a highest court will actually agree with them or not.
Well, I mean, that's an argument that was already ruled upon. And again, maybe that's the argument that they are seeking to distinguish this case from the asylum regulations. And right. maybe they're hanging their hat on that. If that's what they're trying to do, it seems like a pretty thin reed to me. Because look, you can argue that the current secretary of the DHS supports the rule if such a rule exists. The holding of the court under the precedent of the Ninth Circuit is that the rule never existed. It was vacated because it was defective ab initio, from the beginning. It never really existed. There was never a rule. So if you were to, quote, ratify it, unquote, today, how can you ratify something that doesn't exist?
Right. Well, let's move on a little bit here. A lot of people have been asking, so what's going on with USCIS? Do we have a processing update? And some of the information that we are getting is that they are processing 526 petitions, but direct only. They're not processing anything to do with regional centers, but apparently RFEs are getting issued. So I'm not sure what that's supposed to mean.
Well, as best as I know, no one, and we've talked to a number of regional centers and direct petitioners in the last few weeks, no one is reporting any action on any regional center-based 526s. However, those who have filed direct 526s before June 30th of this year, as well as after July 1st of this year, are reporting that they are getting various kinds of correspondence from USCIS, including RFEs and other kinds of routine correspondence at a much faster pace than before. Yeah. Now, that doesn't mean that it's fast enough, but it is faster than before.
Yeah, well, it's a welcome development, but I would say generally that I remember last time there was a lapse, all of our direct EB-5 petitions were adjudicated very, very quickly. And I would presume that this is what's going to happen this time. So that's great. We're seeing shorter processing times, possibly for direct. Are you familiar with any information relating to other?
You mean other petition, like 924s and 829s?
Yes.
Well, 829s are not affected because the 829 authority is apparently in the embedded statute itself. So the 829 is not affected. 924s, on the other hand, are not getting adjudicated. So 924s and regional center 526s are being held in abeyance, at least as of this time.
Yeah, sadly, so far we're not seeing any speed in the new administration, but hopefully that might pick up later on in the year.
And since you mentioned new administration, that is something important to keep in mind. So there are two issues. Firstly, everyone expected that, you know, Joe Biden and Donald Trump are really at two different poles in terms of their approach to immigration policy.
I've heard that.
Yes, everyone expected that USCIS would take a really a 180 degree turn. And that may well happen. Urjadu is still feeling her way through the agency. She's still got to make her presence felt. And she's a very competent woman with a very storied past. She's had achievements in this area. So I'm excited about the future. But so far, look, it's been more than 8 months that Mr. Biden has been in the White House. But so far, what we are seeing is more of the same. Believe it or not, we are seeing the Trump administration, many of its immigration things are being continued, including in court, is defending some of the policies that the Trump administration had put in place. So we aren't seeing as much change as one would have thought. That's number one. Number two, can I briefly touch on the Afghanistan situation?
Sure.
Because it affects EB-5.
Let me yes, it does.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there are two things that I think would be reasonable for USCIS to do within the four square corners of the statute. And again, I'm speaking at a very generalized level of knowledge. There are people who are far greater skilled at reading the statutes than I am. But generally speaking, for an emergency that we have on the border, the unaccompanied minor emergency, and the emergency that we have for the refugees in Afghanistan, for both of those matters, agencies across the board, the Department of Defense, by all means, the Department of Homeland Security and other departments of the United States are being pressed into service to address those emergencies. So if a small quantity of staff were released, for example, from 526 processing to address those emergencies, that would not in the least surprise me. And that would probably be consistent with the discretion that is inherent in running the agency. However, the part that I would be very concerned about is, look, what was the monthly production rate of the agency going back? I think it's a few hundred petitions a month, like 500 or 600, something along those lines, petitions a month, going back the last 3 months, the last 6 months, the last 9 months, the last year. So no matter which way you cut the cake, the point is that the number of cases, 526's cases adjudicated by the agency per month is so large compared to the extremely small number of 526's awaiting adjudication that every single 526 that was pending as of July 1st should have, a direct case, direct 526, should have been adjudicated by now.
Yeah.
So if the agency is not doing it, and if no resources have been released to unaccompanied minors on the southern border or for the Afghan refugees as of this time, then there are certain very strict budget rules at USCIS. People can't be paid just to drink coffee. And
I did have a conversation on one of these lawyer chats that USCIS took a year off, I have to say. So maybe they were paid to just drink coffee.
Well, I mean, certainly the consumption of coffee at USCIS is well above average.
Okay. All right, let's move on. We have a lot to discuss. Legislative update. A lot of people, everybody within the regional center industry wants to know what's going on here. So my conversations with the various stakeholders has shown that at this point, we're still in discussions very much. And the issues are, and the issues which have been thrown out to Senator Leahy, who has taken over the Grassley bill, or he's more, I would say, in the driver's seat right now, is the fact that can this amount be lowered, perhaps to 650 to 750 from 900? Have you been hearing the same?
There is a lot of wishful thinking in the EB-5 industry. And okay. I'm sorry to say that, unfortunately, the EB-5 industry has convinced itself that they have some kind of influence over Congress. And the reality is, if you look at the record, and if you look at the larger perspective of various lobbyists whose interests are involved in Congress, in immigration, and especially outside immigration, the EB-5 industry's belief in its own power is perhaps misplaced. So as best as I can tell, there's all kinds of people with all kinds of ideas in terms of what Congress is being cajoled to do or not do. The key point is this. There are two basic lobbies, as far as EB-5 is concerned. So far, there's been a twist. I'll come to the twist in a second. But Mona, there's two lobbies, right? We all know.
Right.
What are they? The urban lobby and the rural lobby, right?
Right.
And they are, to the best of my knowledge, and I would love to be corrected and be told I'm wrong. I would be ecstatic. But as of right now, my understanding is that they have not, since July 1st till today, not even talked with each other directly. None of the two sides, the principals have actually gotten on a phone call, God forbid, a Zoom meeting or a face-to-face meeting, but they have not even gotten on a phone call with each other. Now, in that kind of situation, I mean, Congress is not unaware of this in the sense that they constantly hear from both sides. They never hear a united voice from the EB-5 industry. And usually what they hear from both sides is not the same piece of music. It's two total discordant pieces of music which clash with each other. And that in that kind of situation, Congress says, okay, so now you're asking us to be Solomon. You're asking us to carve up the baby. And, you know, if we have to do it, that's our job. But that's nobody relishes the idea of carving up the baby. So This is the fundamental problem. And things like lower amounts or liberal TEA definitions or anything else, all of these go out the window until there is one voice. And there is no one voice. Now, things have just gotten even more complicated, Mona, and which is that there is a new voice. It's a third voice, and it is a voice that Congress is hearing. And my guess is that they may hear it more and more. There's a new bill, and it's called the Foreign Investor Fairness Protection Act. FIFPA. It's a one-page bill. And what it has done, this huge lapse, what it really has done is it has driven a wedge between the interests of the past investors and the interests of both the urban and the rural regional centers.
Yeah.
So what I believe is being attempted right now is a permanent amendment to the INA to ensure that regardless of any future lapse, so we're not even talking about how to cure the current lapse, we're talking about that and possible future lapses, that regardless of those two, the interests of the past investors will be protected insofar as their immigration benefits are concerned. And you know what? My suspicion is that Congress may look favorably upon that kind of argument because nothing, not because they care about immigrant investors. No, no, no. Because it is an issue of, this is the word of the United States that's at stake. And if past investors are treated shabbily, then Congress's own policies as to various other future immigration promulgations may not be believed.
Well, and that's true. And also, don't forget, we are talking about a lot of foreign direct investment. And there are a bunch of groups, which is a subject for another podcast, of investors who have now materialized, mushroomed, really, so to speak, to try and have a voice.
Well, absolutely right. That is the key point. You hit the nail on the head. FDI. FDI, foreign direct investment, is much, much larger than just EB-5.
Yeah.
If Congress's word on EB-5 is not to be trusted, which is exactly the way foreign investors are going to read a situation where past investors' immigration benefits were thrown out the window by Congress, either through action or inaction. But if Congress decides that the past investors' reasonable expectations cannot be believed, cannot be upheld, then the point is that Congress's own word on various issues to do with FDI will also be called into question, and the price to be paid for that in the foreign markets can be brutal. I mean, we're talking not billions, but tens of billions, perhaps hundreds of billions of dollars of decisions will be influenced based upon this kind of lapse for what is, from Congress's point of view, a very small technicality. That's why I suspect that FIFPA or something like FIFPA will eventually make it into the Immigration and Nationality Act. So, you know, this lapse has had some permanent consequences, is my gut feeling.
Sam, previously we have had a lapse in the reauthorization of the RC program, but it has never been more than a couple of weeks. This is a long time. And what are your views on timing? Are we going to see something by September 30th or could it be beyond?
Well, so there are two possible windows for getting something enacted. And that something could be different in either of those two windows. So we might see both windows. One is around September 15th to September 30th. And I expect at that point, we will see at a minimum something like FIFPA get enacted. That's a distinct possibility, even a probability perhaps. And then, so somewhere between September 15th to, let's say, October 5th, we can expect something like that to happen. But then in terms of reauthorization, the more I look at it, the more it looks like we're going to slip into October or November. And people are talking, most people I talk to in DC are telling me something about November deadlines, whatever that means. So that's the two windows that we are looking at. So this is an enormous pause. It's a major blow to the industry. There's no other way to cut the cake on this one. As far as regional centers are concerned, this has been a disaster. Infighting amongst the rural and urban lobbies has ended up hurting both.
Yes, I agree. I couldn't agree more. Sam, you do a lot of marketing with developers. I applaud you for the way you do it. You go around the country, around the world pre-COVID, and you really do find an audience. At this point, though, we're talking about direct investments, and we are trying to educate our listeners about the direct investment program, which a lot of people don't understand. I know you have some strong views on this.
Strong views are only because historically, direct investments have been only 3% over the last 5 years, the last 10 years, perhaps even
Well, no, actually, back in the early days, we did do a lot more direct. Then the regional center program sort of took over. Of course, when the Chinese came in, they just wanted the regional center program. But there was this period of time when there was a lot of people interested in franchise and direct stuff. But also, USCIS have been a real pain in the neck when they've been adjudicating direct, mostly because they've people have got the corporate structure or something wrong, and USCIS don't bother even to look beyond the obvious.
You're right that the 1990s and the zeros, 2000s, the first decade of the 2000s was certainly dominated by direct projects, and regional centers were not really much in existence in terms of their presence in the market. But the point is that all the investments for those two decades put together is less than 1 year's worth of investment in the decade that followed between 2010 to 20.
Yeah.
So what I mean is that 3% is roughly the average for the last 5 years, the last 10 years, and the last 30 years of this program has been direct investment. So the strong view I have is that the direct investments, some of them don't realize what a tremendous situation they have right now, where suddenly 97% of their competition has disappeared.
Right.
And it's a very strange situation in the market. Normally, in any capital market, not just EB-5, the situation is always that there is way, way, way more people looking for investors than there are investors available to meet that kind of investment need. That's the usual situation in most capital markets. And at the moment, the way we are seeing it, that the number of investors who have been flooded back into the market because of the lower $500,000 amount is probably double the number of investment slots available in direct investments right now. And one of the reasons is not just the fact that there's a huge number of new people at $500,000 who have come into the market, but it's also because the typical direct project is really small.
Right.
I mean, we're talking, two investors, three investors. So they get filled up pretty quickly. Whereas, in the old days with the big regional center projects, we would have 50 investors, 150 investors, mm-hmm. and those projects could keep going for a while and absorb a lot of investment that's no longer possible. So, for every investor, you're going to have to create 10 actual W-2E verified jobs.
Yeah, that's which is not straightforward. No,
it's not easy to do.
It isn't, especially when you have to fix structure in as well. What we are seeing is a ton of RC direct switches. I think you're seeing the same, where you have an RC project and where it's extrapolating or basically creating a hybrid so that one can use the direct model as well.
Well, I think that that's a very welcome development. Another long-term consequence of this lapse, that going forward, people are going to, almost all of them will try to move to a hybrid model and have both direct and RC, so therefore they can continue their marketing through whatever congressional flavor of the moment is. And on top of that, also because it allows them to hit the market in different ways. There are people who prefer directs, and this way they can cater to both, get their bread buttered on both sides, if you will. But it's not always possible. It depends upon the kind of building you're doing. I mean, for example, if you're a hospital, okay, then the people who are in the building are your employees. So you can easily do the direct and RC together in a hybrid offering. But if you're building an office building, then the people inside the building are your tenant's employees, and tenant occupancy can no longer be counted in any case. So therefore, it's harder for those kinds of developers. So it's a very interesting period in terms of, you're right, structuring is important. Structuring direct is a totally different animal than structuring a regional center project. And, some people are attempting to kind of jury-rig the process. And that's a recipe for disaster because, taking other people's money. You have multiple people unrelated to each other in the same investment pool. Even if it be a small pool of three or four investors, and if you don't structure it correctly, everyone's going to regret it later.
So, Sam, what is your advice right now for developers? And what is your advice for investors?
Well, for investors, it is very simple. If you are comfortable with direct investments, then this is a great time, because there's never been so large a variety or so large a quantity of direct investments available for you to choose from. On the other hand, if you feel more comfortable with regional center investments, then you're going to have to wait and accept that possibly you may have to invest at $900,000 instead of $500,000. That's a possibility, not a probability. In terms of projects, it's very simple. If you can do a direct offering, you would be crazy not to seriously consider it. It's a fantastic seller's market right now, where there is way more people clamoring for investment slots than there are investment slots available. So it's really a golden period for pool direct investments. And if you can possibly get a pool direct offering out in the market, it's a great time to do it.
You know, Sam, I couldn't agree with you more. And I do feel that a lot of direct needs to be demystified, which we hope to get out to our audience coming very soon. In fact, I believe on our next podcast, Mark.
Oh, yes. Five different examples from five different industries. Some great concerns that people have had and debunking some myths about direct pulled projects. And it sounds like it's going to be a very timely episode. Thanks for this update from Sam Udani.
Delighted to be here.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshawlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.